You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, September 13th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Spencer Ackerman, Spackerman, from the Danger Room at Wired, to discuss with us the upcoming attempt by the Palestinian Authority to push for statehood at the UN, U.S. reaction, all things Middle East in terms of, Israel, sort of the heart of the conflict, and more from Spencer Ackerman. Also, the lowlights, sidelights, highlights of the Republican clown car Tea Party. This was like double down on crazy last night. The Republican debate sponsored by CNN. I don't know if CNN is now... They probably got the MoveOn.org debate in the works, right? Of course. Why wouldn't they? But we will have a couple of audio clips. It doesn't take much, actually, folks, to boil this one down. And the big loser, I think, last night was all of them, frankly. And we will talk about that. Special election is today in New York. It's 9. Democrats going to lose. We talked about it quite a bit on the post show. Excuse me, the better half of the program yesterday. And it's unclear what the message is going to be out of this once the Democrat loses. We will get into that. I got a short story we'll probably do in the better half. Well, two of them. One about the implications of cartoons on children, and the fact that I think it's fairly obvious to those of you who have been longtime listeners of this program, starting in 2004 on Air America, you will have noticed this. This seems almost obvious to you, but apparently, after having children and spending any time involved in the raising of those children, men lose a tremendous amount of testosterone. And I think that must be obvious if you've been following me at all and listening to this program over the years. In fact, I think my testosterone level has been falling precipitously for 6 years now. And frankly, it's amazing I still wear pants to work. Let's just put it that way. Just a programming note. I saw a clip of this. A listener sent me a link to a documentary they've done. And I'm a big fan of documentary. People know that. It's not a documentary necessarily that's appropriate for the show, but it's something that I'd love to see, frankly. I saw the trailer. It's called The Laughing Matter. It is premiering at the Burbank International Film Festival on Thursday, September 15th, at 7 p.m. at Flappers Comedy Club. I think that's a real name of a place, Flappers, in Burbank. It's been nominated by the festival for Best Feature Documentary, Best Picture. And I know that some of my audience are comedy nerds. It is following some improv groups involved in UCB and sort of improv competitions, I guess, out there. And the thing that I liked about it is it reminded me of me and the gang of losers that I hung out with 20 years ago, back in the days of cross comedy. And by losers, I mean all people who have gone on to be far more successful than me. That's what I mean when I say that, just in case you were wondering. So check that out if you can. We'll put a link up on the site. Right, Matt? And we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Spencer Ackerman. Then stuff on the debate. President Obama's encouraging proposal to pay for the American Jobs Act. It won't go anywhere, but it's something. And you should know I will be on the Kudlow Report tonight talking about the Republican debate. I think it's going to get uncomfortable. I'm hoping it's going to get uncomfortable. Let's put it that way. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. It is always a pleasure for me, ladies and gentlemen, to welcome to the program from the Danger Room blog at Wired.com and Attackerman.com, Spencer Ackerman. Spencer, welcome.
Thank you for having me back, Sam.
It's my pleasure, and I'm glad to hear that you're not anticipating having a child at any time. I would continue on with that that program.
Yeah, unless my wife wants to tell me something that you'd yet to discuss.
They're sneaking up on you, believe me. I can assure you of that. That's how it goes. And before we get into this stuff about Israel, one other question for you that I thought you'd be a good person. I just saw this before I came on. What do you think the median age? What do you think the median age of Jon Stewart's audience is?
Oh, man. Let me say 35?
Yeah, 41.
41?
Yeah. Isn't that surprising?
These oldsters, man.
Yeah, no
kidding. They're hip with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually younger than me. But, I mean, that said, it's still I'm a little surprised about that. All right. I just thought you'd be an interesting person to, well, you were the first person I spoke to after I saw it, so.
I highballed it. I thought I'd say 35 and be clearly wrong.
Yeah, you thought it would be older, right?
I'm really surprised.
Yeah, it is surprising. Anyway. All right, let's dig into this. Now, a lot of things have been going on in Israel, around Israel, having to do with Israel, from the flotilla to, over the course of the summer, to the recent storming of their embassy, essentially, I guess, in Egypt, to problems with Turkey and the long-anticipated eventuality of the Palestinian Authority going to the UN and pushing for statehood. Let's start with that and then sort of expand outward, shall we? Tell me about that.
Sure. So the Palestinian Authority is this divided and weak entity. It controls only the West Bank. It doesn't control Gaza at all. Its enemies in Hamas control Gaza. Efforts at reconciliation with Hamas have failed. There are lots of stumbling blocks there. And then it also has to face the intransigence of the Israelis who just refuse to cease settlement activity in the West Bank to the satisfaction of the Palestinian Authority. So there's really no peace process to speak of. And for the last couple months, the Palestinian Authority has been warning that it was going to just play a different card all of a sudden. That card is to go to the United Nations General Assembly when it convenes in New York next week and say, we've been under occupation for over 40 years. We're out of options with the peace process. We are a mature political entity that over the past 20 years has basically built itself a state in waiting in the West Bank. We deserve observer status at the United Nations. We believe there ought to be a state of Palestine. And the rule in the UN General Assembly is that there's no veto to be exercised. So the whole world can vote on whether they believe a new state of Palestine should be admitted, and overwhelmingly they will. Just no one believes that the U.S., that the Palestinians would lose that vote. And the Israelis are freaked out about that because it means that if they get observer status, the Palestinians can do things like take Israel to the International Criminal Court, for instance. It won't, you know, automatically mean a wave of the multilateral wand and all of a sudden the occupation of the West Bank is over and Palestine is, you know, a functional state. But it changes the leverage on Israel significantly. And so Israel's reached out to the United States, which in the Security Council has a veto over really any business that goes forward. And the United States is now furiously reaching out basically all around the world in the United Nations to stop the Palestinians from taking this step. They're warning of a potential cutoff of all aid by an angry U.S. Congress. They're warning of a total deterioration in the peace process, the prospect of renewed violence, and on and on and on. And increasingly, it just appears that American diplomacy is just isolated on this issue. The Palestinians don't care. They're at the end of their tether. And there's an irony that the only other entity, aside from the U.S. and Israel, that's opposed to statehood here and the United Nations gambit is Hamas, the Palestinian Authority's enemy. And they're opposed to it because they want all of the land, all of what's now Israel, the West Bank and Gaza, to just be Palestine. And so you've got this odd alliance of interests between the U.S., Israel, and Hamas on one hand, and essentially the rest of the world on the other.
So now let's just start with the what would constitute the nation of Palestine? Would it not have necessarily borders drawn, or would it just include the West Bank, or would it simply be a sort of a nation in exile, or a nation without borders? I mean, how would that work?
Well, so there's no draft at the United Nations General Assembly of what this resolution would be, so it's hard to say. But, you know, no matter what it says, the facts on the ground will still be what they are today, which means that the United Nations would basically be expressing its desire for Palestine to be state and to give it certain diplomatic benefits that states enjoy. On the ground, nothing really is going to change.
Well, what are the implications? What are the implications for Gaza and Hamas's control if the Palestinian Authority succeeds in getting this type of status at the UN? Does it diminish Hamas in terms of being any type of representative for Gaza? I mean, where did the reconciliation attempts leave us with Hamas and the Palestinian Authority? Because my sense is that I don't have a sense of what the dynamic is between those two players right now.
Yeah, the vote in the UN wouldn't do anything there. Hamas would still be in control of Gaza. The facts on the ground would remain the facts on the ground. What some Palestinian Authority leaders believe is that all of a sudden Hamas would have to take the emotionally difficult position of telling Palestinians in Gaza that they don't believe they should be part of this state. It creates a political awkwardness potentially for Hamas, but nothing that actually changes, you know, the day after the vote.
And so what leverage does the United States have? I mean, they're not going to go to the Security Council with this resolution, or I should say the members, obviously, of the Security Council will be able to vote on, but not, they don't have the veto power that they have with things that just go to the Security Council. So what leverage does the United States have other than sort of saying, like, vote against this? I mean, there's no way the United States can corral enough votes to vote against this, right? I mean, what are they trying to, what leverage do they have?
They have none. And no one seriously believes that the Palestinians would lose this vote. What the U.S. is desperately trying to do right now is convince Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority president, that he just shouldn't do this. That the only way the state of Palestine can be established is through direct negotiations with Israel, overseen by the United States, and somehow convince the Palestinians that they have more to lose by going to the UN on this than they have to gain. And it's hard to see, you know, the United States can basically threaten the Palestinian Authority. It can say that, you know, you risk a cutoff of aid and other, you know, deleterious diplomatic reprisals. But, you know, actual leverage, you know, at this point, the Palestinian Authority sort of feels like it's gone as far as it can go. The Obama right. administration is not, you know, significantly pressured Israel, certainly not sufficiently from the perspective of the Palestinian Authority. The peace process is, you know, dead in the water. So, you know, it's hard to see what the Palestinian Authority can be convinced by at this case, that going to the UN is somehow not in its interest.
Now, and so from your perspective and various commentators, is there a downside for the Palestinians to, you know, I mean, we can speculate as to what the implications are going to be in terms of aid from the United States, et cetera, but is there really a material downside? I mean, it does seem like to try and sell the Palestinians on the notion of, like, you shouldn't do this, it's going to foreclose the peace process is a little bit, I mean, there's not much of a peace process really to be foreclosed at this point, is there?
So there's just not. I mean, we're, you know, it's just not right. there. You know, there were, like, let's break up two different categories of disincentive, right? One is the rest of the world would have, you know, something the rest of the world would do, the United States or Israel would do in response to the UN gambit, and the other is deleterious responses that the gambit itself would have, right? In the latter category, my friend Mark Leon Goldberg, who's an excellent United Nations deep journalist, points out that, you know, if Palestine gets statehood, it can take Israel to the International Criminal Court to refer cases for potential war crimes prosecution. But Israel would also have that option. If Palestine becomes a state, then rocket attacks on civilian villages in southern Israel by Hamas, other, you know, suicide bombings or terrorist attacks that Palestinian terrorists have launched against Israel, those could considerably be brought before the ICC as well. So there's that. Then there's the category of responses that the move would engender by other parties, which are essentially optional by those parties. You know, who knows? Like, Israel could decide, you know, to launch a bigger security crackdown in the West Bank. It could decide that, you know, it'll step up its maritime embargo of goods into Gaza. The United States Congress could cut off all aid to the Palestinians, and, you know, that's not an inconceivable threat. And the state of Palestine, you know, would be, as it is now, as long as the Israeli occupation of the West Bank is ongoing, entirely dependent on Israel to disperse its essentially tax receipts. The Israelis control that. This is, you know, part of what the lack of the independence of Palestine means. So, you know, Israel could basically decide it's you know, going to just withhold all of this international aid from Palestine. So there's that.
It seems like a fairly weak argument by the Israelis and the Americans. I mean, I guess it's possible that the American Congress may respond in this way because, frankly, our politics here about that region are so messed up. But it doesn't seem like much of a threat. Like, we have the ability to do this anyways. We may do it if you decide to strengthen your hand in some fashion. So, all right. So with that said, it's so interesting the way this is playing out both in American politics. I just forwarded you something that came from the Obama, the OFA list, where Netanyahu congratulated or express gratitude to President Obama for his help with this thing in Egypt. What happened in Egypt?
So Israel was one of the last holdouts of international support for the dictator Hosni Mubarak, because Israel fears that a democratic Egypt is going to be an Egypt that's hostile to Israel. Israel's security strategy is predicated as a bedrock principle that its 30-year peace treaty with Egypt will hold. And it really didn't want to gamble that a new democratic Egypt was going to be less of a committed peace partner. It also required Egypt, or you know, was relying on Mubarak's Egypt to stop the flow of weapons and material through tunnels from Egypt into Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
And those, you know, that acquiescence from Mubarak was a huge, huge aggravator of Egyptian politics. The Egyptians felt that Mubarak was selling out the Palestinians, and it was a big emotional issue. During protests by Egypt's increasingly vulnerable and unfinished revolutionaries, on Friday, that resulted in storming of the Israeli embassy in Cairo, which is just a huge, huge deal. Israel basically appealed to and successfully got American assistance in getting its diplomats out and stopping the riot before something more serious could happen. And that's been from, you know, what I can read in the Israeli press, it's just sent a shockwave that perhaps now at this moment of greater diplomatic isolation over the Israel-Palestine issue, one of the foundational aspects of Israeli security might find itself on the chopping block, or just, you know, no longer as reliable as it used to be. And when you consider that the rest of the region is erupting in this democratic fervor, you know, most of the rest of the world sees that as pretty much a good thing. The Israelis are really worried that that's going to mean a lack of a bulwark against popular hostility to Israel.
And so Israel is at a sort of, I would imagine, right about now, Israel's at a peak paranoia. And meanwhile, they seem to just keep putting gasoline on the fire, because on another front, there's been a long time, a good relations, I guess, between Israel and Turkey. I know just like the Israeli people, like the young people, the more secular people travel to Turkey all the time. That's where they get married, I think, a lot of the secular people. And that relationship seems to have completely fallen apart over the past year.
So one of what's kind of go down in the annals of just disastrous statecraft has been the Israeli-Turkey relationship, as you say. You know, it wasn't long ago when, you know, there were discussions of arms sales between these two countries. It looked like Israel and Turkey were, you know, going to have a really close relationship, you know, something Israel desperately wants with Islamic countries. Basically, since the flotilla incident, in which, you know, Israeli commandos stormed a humanitarian aid ship bound for Gaza to test the maritime embargo of Gaza, the relationship has just fallen apart. There have been mutually insulting statements by each of their diplomats, you know, now they just barely talk at all. One of the more egregious things I've seen is that there were reports that the Israeli foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, might actually visit with a Kurdish terrorist group that Turkey considers the number one threat to its security. And if that actually happens, and, you know, the fact that Netanyahu hasn't publicly denounced that sort of thing, it would just basically be the end of any Israel-Turkey relationship. It's pretty much impossible to see how that relationship can be salvaged if the foreign minister of Israel meets with a terrorist group that Turkey is rather brutally suppressing.
You know, I should remind people that as far right nut job as Netanyahu is, Avigdor Lieberman is, I think it's fair to say, and I don't know if he refers to himself this way, as a fascist. I mean, this guy is just out and out horrible.
He's a racialist.
A racialist.
In European politics, you would understand Lieberman perfectly as a racialist. He believes that there ought to be a loyalty oath that non-Jewish citizens of Israel recite to Israel as a Jewish country. You know, it's nearly impossible to imagine that, you know, my fellow Jews would agree to be represented by someone who would express such a noxious sentiment and one that has such horrific reverberations of our own past.
Now, so with all of these things put together here, we have, just as a slight sort of backdrop, we have a situation where you've got this race in New York's 9th district, and there's at least some talk that it, you know, part of the reason why the Democrats going to lose in Anthony Weiner's district is because of Israel. So my question to you is, when we're on the verge of the Palestinians coming to the UN, attempting to get statehood, how much pressure does Obama feel to get involved in this and to make it look like he is against this play for Palestinian statehood for domestic political reasons, very narrow ones, I should say.
Well, why do you assume that he's just appearing to be against it?
Well, I guess I think the intensity. I should put it this way: why would the U.S. government be against the Palestinian statehood absent any domestic pressure?
Well, because perhaps Obama feels, or the United States government feels, that its bigger priority is maintaining the relationship with Israel, and this is something the Israeli government fervently dislikes. The reason why I ask that question is because I've seen no evidence that, like, Obama, like, secretly really wants the Palestinians to go to the UN and declare statehood. You know what I mean? Like,
no, no, no. I don't mean to imply that he is going against his will, that he's a secret, you know, that he is a separate agenda. I guess I'm talking in a broader sense. In terms of U.S. interest, there, you make a fairly good argument in your piece that it would be a great it may be a very advantageous thing for the United States government in terms of its perception in that world to support this, particularly since it seems to be a fait accompli. And my question to you is, when you do the analysis, is there really such a great cost to be paid? I mean, Netanyahu doesn't seem to listen to Obama anyways. That we seem to have no leverage with the Israeli government on any front. There is no peace process. My question to you is, what is the cost to the United States government, aside from any type of domestic policy? What is the real cost and what is the real benefit in supporting this attempt by the Palestinians to get statehood?
I mean, the domestic political cost is what it is, and I have to believe that, you know, a huge driving factor.
But put that aside. You know, I mean, think about it in terms of if that didn't exist.
So what are the diplomatic consequences to opposing statehood to the United States and the region? They're extraordinary. If you look at an op-ed that a member of the Saudi royal family, Prince Turki, published in the New York Times earlier this week, he was basically saying, like, it would be a cataclysm in the region, a region that, you know, had such hope for Obama, that listened so intently to his speech in Cairo about wanting a new relationship with the Muslim world, one based on dignity and justice, that's, you know, watched Obama kind of sort of figure out what it is he believes and what it is the U.S. believes about the Arab Spring, and still holds out, you know, some kind of hope for a better and more constructive relationship with the United States. For the United States to say that it will oppose statehood for Palestine, people just stop listening after that. No one's going to believe, it's just not credible, that, you know, the takeaway from the region is, oh, the United States really does believe in statehood for Palestine and just believes that the Palestinians are going about it the wrong way. Like, not at all. That's just, like, you just can't imagine that anyone in the State Department is really listening to how this sounds in Arabic as opposed to in English. The idea that the United States is just on the verge of making just a huge, huge diplomatic blunder really needs to just stare American diplomats you know, Secretary Clinton, President Obama in the face, it's going to be viewed as something immensely alienating and provocative to millions of people in one of the world's most volatile regions. And the United States is doing it essentially when it doesn't have to. The United States could take a different position. It could say that, you know, this is something that will weaken Hamas, that will be more conducive to restarting the peace process on a more equal footing, and that it doesn't actually foreclose any options by the Israelis. In fact, it's hard to see if what the Israelis really care about is weakening Hamas as opposed to maintaining the occupation in the West Bank. It isn't jumping at the chance to marginalize Hamas potentially.
And so what is the cost? So that's the cost of the United States basically being actively trying to lobby against this Palestinian statehood. What is the cost if they were to follow your prescription, or even be, you know, somewhat ambivalent about it? I mean, what is the cost on the Israeli side? I mean, it would hurt relations with Israel, but at this point, isn't Israel isolated themselves so much that they don't have many options here?
Yeah, I don't believe it. I mean, when Israel, you know, despite the icy relationship between Obama and Netanyahu, still called the United States to bail itself out of the jam, it's pretty clear what the actual structural dynamic of that is.
Right.
Israel is not going to want to, you know, who's it going to rely on? Russia? China? You know, it's just not credible. But Obama never plays that card. It never, you know, he never says to Netanyahu, it's time for you to remember who's the client here. And I, you know, Obama, you know, given that that's not the way, you know, he wants to play diplomat. And, you know, it's actually a fairly good argument why not. It's not really a way you want to treat your allies. That's really bare knuckle. At the same time, you know, Obama, you know, would face definitely domestic political pressure from Republicans and Democrats about how he just sold out Israel at the United Nations. And Israel's allies in the United States would probably want to, you know, go to work defeating Obama in the general election. But the, you know, a whole lot of the pro-Israel community in the United States, you know, its institutions are pretty much against Obama. Jews in the United States, you know, he got something like over, you know, 70-odd%. I forget what it was, but it was like astronomically high. You know, Jews in 2008 really went for Obama, and it's really hard to see that not happening again. So, you know, I'm not really sure that really many people.
Well, I mean, but we're at the point where when we talk about domestic pressure of support of Israel, we're not really talking anymore about the plurality or even the majority, the vast majority of Jews. I mean, what we're talking about.
Yeah, I think you're totally right about that.
That is the fundamental mistake, I think, that people are making, you know, when they talk about that. I mean, yes, it is the case, perhaps maybe in this one district in New York, and maybe there's about a half dozen other districts around the nation that are similar, but we're talking about an extremely powerful lobbying organization that deals with it, essentially just funded by right-wing wealthy Jews, extremely wealthy Jews, and then we're talking about masses of Christian Zionists.
I think that's really what I think more than any Jewish organization in the United States, the real pressure here comes from that Christian right.
Absolutely.
My friend Matt Iglesias has this wonderful, wonderful phrase in which he says that the United States has entered, or you know, Israel politics in the United States has entered into what he called the era of post-Jewish Zionism.
Yep.
That American Jews who are overwhelmingly liberal, they're typical, you know, people like me, basically. Our emotional ties with Israel and our desire to see, you know, Israel maintain itself as a humane and liberal open society, and express our political beliefs to what the United States' relationship with Israel ought to be on that basis, are just irrelevant these days.
Right.
You know, what matters a lot more is that the people who believe that Israel is essentially a tool to bring about a millenarian solution to the problem of, you know, godlessness around the world are the people who, from an electoral percent, from a financial perspective, and, you know, definitely from an organizing perspective, matter a whole lot more. And Israel is an emotional tie. It's not a geopolitical concern. It's certainly not in the same degree that it is to American Jews. And I think that's the constellation of forces that American policy on Israel really faces at its core.
Spencer Ackerman of the Danger Room, thank you so much. And let me just ask you finally, if the apocalypse comes, do you have any sense where that's going to put the price of gold?
Oh, man, it's going to be, pretty sky high. We're going to see a run on it. What I'm also, however, hoping for is cheaper available locks from Russ and Daughters, which is really hard to get in D.C. On the other hand, if, people like you and me are the only guys left, then we better start hoarding it now.
I'm already reserved my seat on the right-hand side of God. I know there's two-thirds that are going to go of the Jews are going to go into the eternal fire. I have to opt out of that because of my eczema. It's really bad for my eczema.
Well, if you could put in a word for me, I'd appreciate that. And it would make you vastly more inclined to be on your show next time.
Well done. Spencer Ackerman, Danger Room at Wired.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We're going to take a break. We'll come back, and we will do some quick rundown on the Republican debate just after this. So, folks, if you did not see the Republican debate last night, the Tea Party CNN debate, you don't really have to watch it. Really, at the end of the day, this clip is the only clip that you need to see if you are interested in both knowing what the Republican debate was about last night, and in fact, what the Republican Party is about. This is the question that should be asked at every single debate, and it should be asked about three or four different ways. Wolf Blitzer, and he presented this question to Ron Paul, because it's easy to dismiss Ron Paul. Because every single Republican candidate should answer this question, because this is the fundamental question about conservative governance. It is the question they cannot answer. It is the question they will not answer truthfully. And when they do, they will be fundamentally rejected by the American public. And when I say that Michelle Bachmann proved in her speech following President Obama's State of the Union, where she spoke into the camera of the Tea Party, but the rest of the country saw her looking off camera and talking. At that time, I said that is a perfect metaphor. You cannot address the Tea Party and make sense to them without seeming insane to the rest of the country. And here is the Tea Party. Here is Ron Paul being asked, and this is a question that should go to every Republican. They would not be able to answer this question. You have a 30-year-old man. He's made a decent living. He decides not to pay for health care, $200 or $300 a month, whatever it is. You should be lucky to get health care at that price, frankly. And he gets into an accident. He goes into a coma. He has no money to pay health insurance. What should be done? Listen to this. Listen to this.
Governor, before I get to Michelle Bachmann, I want to just, you're a physician, Ron Paul, so you're a doctor. You know something about this subject. Let me ask you this hypothetical question. A healthy 30-year-old young man has a good job, makes a good living, but decides, you know what? I'm not going to spend $200 or $300 a month for health insurance because I'm healthy. I don't need it. But, something terrible happens. All of a sudden, he needs it. Who's going to pay for if he goes into a coma,
well,
for example?
Who
pays for that?
In a society that you accept welfareism and socialism, he expects the government to take care
of him. What do you
want? But what he should do is whatever he wants to do and assume responsibility for himself. My advice to him would have a major medical policy, but not before.
But he doesn't have that. He doesn't have it, and he needs intensive care for 6 months. Who pays?
That's what freedom is all about, taking your own risks. This whole idea that you have to prepare and take care of everybody.
But Congressman, are you saying the society should just let him die?
No. I practiced medicine before we had Medicaid in the early 1960s when I got out of medical school. I practiced at Santa Rosa
yes,
Hospital.
The answer is yes. They cheer yes. Let him die. That is the conservative movement now. And maybe it's always been that. That is a question that every single candidate should be asked. And then they should be asked, what if that person didn't have the money to pay for health insurance? What if the choice was between their rent or their food or their health insurance? What if they didn't have the ability to pay for it? Should society let him die? What if that man has children and he doesn't have money to insure those children? Should those children, should society let those children die? That is the question that should be asked. And you will either get a response that throws out their entire ideology out the window and shows how they pick and choose, despite the fact that they live on these broad principles of freedom and choice and liberty, which is a bunch of sack of crap. Because it means nothing. Or that they really do believe that society should just let people die, even when society has the ability to save them.
The Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act says that the hospitals can't turn away the sick simply because they can't pay for the care. And Ronald Reagan is the one who signed that into law.
That's right. Emergency rooms don't function terribly well, and they cost us all money because somebody's got to pay for those. And when you have someone who's in an acute situation, they got to pay for it. But it was Ronald Reagan who signed that act. It just goes to show you how extreme they are. And each one of those presidential candidates should have to answer that question. And if there are any journalists who are involved in the next debates, they will. And kudos to Wolf Blitzer. I wish he had the courage to ask some of the other mainstream candidates. Because he asked Ron Paul under the guise of he's a doctor. That's the issue isn't that Ron Paul is a doctor. The issue is, if you were president, do you think things like Medicare are unconstitutional? We'll get into this debate more on the flip side. There's a couple of other points I want to make about this. But we're going to do it in the better half of the program, folks. We got a couple of great clips. We will break down in the better half what the implications of each one of them said. What would you bring to the White House? It is as if you had 5 years to spend with these people on the couch as to what their answers are. I will break down each one of them. We'll also play that clip of Perry, where he makes the argument, hey, I may be a whore, but I'm not a cheap whore. Everything you needed to know and didn't want to, or did want to, about the debate. Folks, join us in the better half. You can, if you're a member, you can sign up at majority.fm. Your 33 cents a day not only allows you to hear, you know, 5 minutes into, 40 minutes, 50 minutes into the better half of the show, it also ensures that I can do the first 40 minutes. When I go on to Kudlow tonight and tell him, ask him that question, would you let that guy die, Larry? I understand that it is because the members pay for this show that I can stay in this business and go and do that. Otherwise, I'm not sure exactly what I would be doing. But I know I wouldn't have. Unless I won the lottery. I guess you could all buy me lottery tickets. You get my point. You can also support this show by going to justcoffee.coop, buying some coffee there, coffee, tea, chocolate, fair trade. It's great coffee. There's no reason for you not to. If you drink coffee, you should be buying justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. I get a little kickback on that. You get a 10% discount. If you insist on buying your crap through Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link. I get a couple of dollars back on that. You won't know the difference. You can also support the show by telling your friends about it. DonateYourAccount.com/MajorityFM.
You can support the show by giving it a good rating on iTunes, letting people know there's a product out there they're going to want. And it's not a product that's going to kill them, make them stupider. It's not going to make them smell better. But it'll project a more testosterone-laden self to the world. I mean, all right, join me in the better half.